You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Welcome to National Security Law Today, the podcast of the ABA's Standing Committee on Law and National Security. I'm Elisa Poteet. It's good to have you on our podcast tonight because we're recording at the end of Civics Week. I have no idea who declared Civics Week, but I think we should have a Civics Month, in my opinion. So on that score, we thought we would talk to somebody who's given probably more thought to civics than any of us has in the past. Michael Foyer is the Dean of the Graduate School of Education and Human Development at the George Washington University. And recently, and most importantly, he is the author of Can Schools Save Democracy? Civic Education and the Common Good. He's also the host of the EdFix podcast, which you can find on iTunes or your listening app of choice. Michael, thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me. I look forward to our conversation.
All right. Well, Bob Gates, Sandra Day O'Connor, and our own dear committee members, Suzanne Spaulding and Elizabeth Rinskoff Parker, they've all emphasized the importance of civics education and maintaining our democracy, or I think as Benjamin Franklin said, keeping our republic, but also in protecting our national security from foreign influence. Civics education is thought to be a pretty good buffer against malign foreign influence campaigns that bombard us on social media, even more so in this election year. So I'd like to establish a baseline. How do you define civics and civics education?
First of all, there's a difference between civics with the S and civic education without the S. And the way I distinguish them is that civic education is really what we want everybody to have an opportunity to get better at, to know more about the workings of our system, the workings of our government, the workings of our messy pluralist democracy. Civics with the S is essentially what we usually mean by what we try to impart to young people in school, or for that matter, almost young people as they get into college and beyond. So there's a distinction between the rather more generalized and possibly informal need for all functioning members of the society to have an understanding of basic principles and basic rules of democracy. And then there's the question of civics, which is how do we get this into schools with teachers who can actually do a good job of laying out the groundwork so that young people who are destined, we hope, to become leaders have a good sense of the issues that we care about. With respect to what's included in that, like most other things in education in America, if there are 10 people in a room, you'll get 15 opinions, all expressed with great expertise about what ought to be included and how to do it right. And so now that we have this revival of interest in civics with the S and civic education without the S, it's not surprising that we have a lot of definitions running around about what ought to be included in that. I like to start with a kind of set of ideas that I think give a reasonably good approximation, and that would be knowledge, skills, dispositions, and engagement. If you think about those four words as capturing most of what matters in terms of what we want young people to know and be able to do in our democracy, I think that's a pretty good starting point. In my book, I emphasized primarily the knowledge part because I want young people to have better grounding in some core principles and some core ideas about how the democracy works. Skills, that goes a little bit more to the idea that whatever people do in their life, that they will have an opportunity, hopefully, to interact with others and to have a good sense of what it really means to engage with people who have different points of view and who have different kinds of knowledge. So now you can see how all of this is getting a little bit mixed up here, because part of skill is actually the skill of engagement with others, the skill of listening, the skill of interacting which of course relates to the D word, disposition. So we want young people to feel comfortable confronting different points of view and understanding why we have tensions and why we have rules and how we manage in this very complicated government and governmental system.
Okay, so I want to also pull out a few skills that I heard you mention or allude to. The first one is listening, having the ability to listen to different points of view and being willing to hear other points of view. Obviously, that can become harder in a social media environment. It's rather reductive. But the second one is critical thinking around anything that you're hearing. But I did flag something that you said in there, and it really stood out to me, which is that sort of confronting other people's opinions. It is important to have the internal fortitude to be able to hear, no matter how offensive you find it, another person's point of view. I'm not sure that any of that is presently taught at a low enough level in school. In other words, I think it is largely introduced by the time you're in high school, if you're working on debate groups or something. But that sort of critical thinking piece, I'm wondering in terms of brain development, quite plainly here, if that doesn't need to begin far earlier, just as a matter of science. At some point in our history, we must have taught civics in the schools, and we must not be doing that any longer. Is that right?
I think the first part of that is mostly right. But I would differentiate between civics as a self-contained kind of subject or something that has its own curriculum. And to remember that in the history of American education, at least, a lot of the ingredients of what fall under the heading of civics was actually taught in a very diffused way across lots of the curriculum. So you had geography class, you had an economics class, you certainly had history. The intent, or at least the unspoken in some cases, intent was that through all of that, young people would get a set of knowledge and to some extent, some skill. We can get back to that point that you raised. But in fact, the basic approach in American educational history was to orient young people toward an understanding of these complex overlapping issues, not necessarily with its own formal curriculum. Now, that's a kind of interesting obstacle because now you have this quite robust revival of public interest in civics and how to teach it. And when we look around, we see a lot of, well, I suppose the word would be diversity in the way it's defined and in the way it is organized. You have some places where it is much more formally laid out in standards and in curricula and in almost and in mandates, even from state education offices, about what is taught under the rubric of civics. In other places, it is still rather more loosely organized. It's in the social studies, it's in history. But by and large, I would argue that civics with a small c, that is not as its own curriculum, but civics as a set of ideas and knowledge was always part of the American public school system. In fact, going back to the early days, there was a belief that just the fact of having people gather in classrooms and be exposed to ideas and be encouraged to start thinking critically about those ideas, they were getting a very important kind of exposure to what we now refer to rather more, you know, as a summary word, as civics. So the short answer is we've always taught civics. We have, however, had big swings in American educational history and even in American educational philosophy, where for a long time, the concept of public schooling and education was primarily to prepare people to function effectively in our political system. it was to also be a place where people would develop a kind of value system about some of those democratic principles. Over time, that pendulum has swung, and we've come through periods when, if one were to ask, what's the main purpose of schooling, the answer would have been a little bit less on the let's prepare people to function effectively. Let's prepare people with skills for the economy. And we are just now possibly at another point of transition where after, I don't know, 40 years, 50 years of very heavy emphasis on schooling as a place to develop what we economists refer to as human capital is now becoming again challenged by the notion that schooling is intended to prepare people for functioning, productive lives in the democracy, which has some bearing on skills and the economy, but goes to a lot of other things that we want young people to be getting better at.
Well, there are vicissitudes in the economy. And I think if we're always ever preparing people for one thing, which is to contribute to the GDP, contribute to the economy, I think as the economy falters in certain areas, and I'm thinking of Rust Belt towns and so on, then I think that the promise of the republic, of the democracy, can seem tarnished in that moment if that's always how we value individuals. If that's the signal that we're sending from early days, then I think that can become a problem. Now, certainly, I do think it's in the common good that everyone contribute to the economy who can. There's sort of the loss of esteem, I think, in places in this country where valuing people different through the education, the civics education that you describe, would have long-term benefits to the United States that may not always be apparent. One of the things that I find just listening to Americans, you know, when they're interviewed, they're most confused about is separation of powers. It seems to me that even many of them can't name the vice president or, you know, maybe one Supreme Court justice. They certainly couldn't name any of the cabinet heads very easily, but new immigrants can do better, actually, people who've just taken the citizenship test. I think they don't really understand what Congress does versus what the president, the executive, is supposed to do. And I think that is really apparent with a lot of the people who showed up on January 6th. I think it's really been apparent in some of this partisan nonsense and sort of wedge issues that we've experienced where people are very confused. And I think civics education could go a long way to clearing that up. What are your thoughts about the role of civics education in reestablishing a lingua franca and sort of a baseline common understanding that could lead people to a feeling of acting more in the common good?
On the business of the fact that young people, and for that matter, many adults, don't actually know the names of their own elected officials and have that sort of a deficit, that's interesting. And it is something of a problem because we would like to think that we know more about how we live and where we live. Now, you relate this to what I think is a more consequential problem. And that is that one of the virtues of the American pluralist experiment is that it actually promotes argument. I think a certain amount of partisanship is absolutely essential to a democracy. Places that don't have a vibrant argument, it's either because there's something in the drinking water or there's some totalitarian head of state who has figured out the answers for everybody. So I like the idea that we are an argumentative people, so to speak. What has happened over the last 40 years is that the idea of healthy argument among people who have opposing points of view has been allowed to turn into something where people with an opposing point of view are enemies. The third thing I'll say in response to what you were just saying is on the business of immigrants who take a naturalization exam and actually end up looking like they know more than, you know, we who were born here. First of all, just for you to know, there are some places, I think Wisconsin today, uses the citizenship exam, the naturalization exam, as a way of estimating, of measuring whether high school kids, their civics knowledge, They're using the naturalization exam. Again, you got to take all of this with a little bit of salt. The naturalization exam has been sort of satirized and criticized from the get-go. Either the questions are trivial, in which case, what's the point? Or the questions are interesting enough that some significant percentage of people who already have citizenship would flunk. And again, the idea of using some kind of a metric from the naturalization experience is kind of interesting because it provokes exactly this sort of discussion. You know, for a lot of this stuff, I think you just got to take some of this with a little bit of salt.
And that may be, but we do live in a time of congressional dysfunction and, the expanding unitary executive. When you have a president who's having to issue executive orders on all manner of, things because people on the Hill can't get along, some of the acrimony may be caused by the amount of money that it costs now to run any kind of an election and keep your seat in Congress, whatever chamber. But when you have, as rumors are right now, President Trump, for example, saying, you know, you can't agree to this border bill, if you will, under any circumstances, because we can't let them have a win, that becomes the basis for a decision, which then makes it impossible for anybody to do anything, which then forces the executive to do something to manage any kind of an escalating concern, whatever it may be. I do think that it's not just an issue of the whether you can name your senator or so on. I think it's more, do you understand the structure of your government? And frankly, if you're sitting up there, do you understand what your role is? Your role isn't necessarily to get reelected.
Whenever we are made aware of these kinds of what I consider, and I agree with you, this is a crisis in the way our elected officials seem to be so unable to do something that they used to do with gusto, which is argue from their point of view and then respectfully understand where they agree and disagree and then make a decision.
And go have lunch with each other, for God's sake, you know?
Now, just by the way, I have to tell you, during Civics Week, I had a wonderful experience because, among other things, at George Washington University, we were very lucky to host a kind of one-hour conversation between two Supreme Court justices who are known to disagree on most of the big issues. This was Justice Sotomayor and Justice Coney Barrett. And they made a very compelling case for the difference between disagreeing on the substance of these cases and agreeing to be respectful and to work together and to figure out where there might be points of agreement and not, rather than view themselves, again, not as opponents, but as enemies. Because if they viewed themselves only as enemies, if you think what's going on now is bad, you can just imagine that the Supreme Court also would become a place of, you know, hopeless impossibility of getting judgments that people believed in. Part of it is interesting because whenever we are in a crisis in this country, people think, well, we've got to do something with the schools because clearly they must be doing something wrong if we have this many people running the country who don't know how to, you know, engage. What's going on in civics education? I would hope that I could get people to agree that the cause of our current crisis is not entirely the schools, nor is the solution to this crisis going to be entirely the schools. So social media, that's a terrific example of something that I would love at least more of our young people to appreciate, not so much from the standpoint of whether to believe or not believe, although there's some terrific work going on helping young people become more skilled at distinguishing information from misinformation. Actually, there's some very good results from new curricula and new approaches to helping young people manage when they are bombarded with media and with opinions and with statements that don't have any of that kind of curation that we used to be accustomed to.
Put some gloss on that for us before you get off that topic, because I think that's important. If that's occurring somewhere, Where is it happening? And is this something that could be expanded and embraced by other states? Or is it going to be perceived as some sort of plot to suppress ideas, which I think has limited some efforts in the past? So where do you see it happening successfully?
Okay, well, for example, there is now an organization called the Digital Inquiry Group. For example, I would encourage our listeners to look at that website, the Digital Inquiry Group, and you'll find there lots of curricula that have been downloaded by millions of teachers across the country, with research to back it up that shows how people can actually be taught or guided to becoming more, shall we say, discriminating users of social media.
This is out of Stanford, is it not? The Stanford Internet Research Group, which is fabulous. And we've had many of the professors there on the podcast over the years, and they're fantastic.
But another example is something called, I'm sure that you've had experience with this organization, called Facing History and Ourselves. Again, this is not a single state or state office. It is an independent organization that develops really interesting curricula and professional development of our teachers with some very creative modules and some very creative ways to solve one of the big predicaments that teachers have, which is go into a classroom, try to be relevant, and try to not allow your own ideology or your point of view from becoming too dominant in the classroom, but rather to engage young people to think critically and learn thereby about these complex issues. Again, the big predicament in American public education is, can we continue to believe that the purpose of schooling is to help young people learn how to think more than what to think?
Absolutely. I think that the advent of social media is an iconoclasm. It's part of the same iconoclasm that AI is in. And I think whenever there are these shifts from hunter-gatherer societies to agricultural, anything that is a massive and seismic shift in society, there are these wild upheavals in terms of how people deal with one another, whether institutions, families, places even survive on the other side of it. And I think we're not even 25% into, I think, this big shift.
Look, I don't want to be misunderstood as thinking that this shift and social media and AI are inconsequential or trivial. I do think, however, that we have had historically periods of horrible turmoil, violence, genocide that did not rely on either the internet or AI. I sometimes kid people and say, just imagine if Father Coughlin had a social media site, he could have really caused some harm.
For listeners, if you don't know, dreadful man, really. He was a priest in Detroit.
Priest.
He was a Nazi. He was basically, and he put out pro-Nazi messages. By the way, he was never excommunicated fully.
He did all that without AI, and he did all that without social media. So the lesson from all this is that it's not so much the technology. It is rather the curious coincidence of a lot of things converging in society that enabled a guy of limited real knowledge and intelligence, but great skill with the microphone, to produce all of that chaos. And what I would like people to appreciate is that just as it was radio technology that, shall we say, enabled Father Coughlin, it was also not just radio technology, but other things that the society was willing and able to do that brought him down.
I think our opinion is he was also a tool of a foreign government. His radio show and his dispensing of that poison coincided with Viertek's presence in the United States to get out the pro-Nazi message in the hopes of keeping us out of the war. Because once we came in, we were going to kick ass, take names, and win the thing. and the Nazis were going to be out of business. And he did this through the period of time when the Holocaust was ongoing. I don't know that every American knew it was ongoing, but you're right. It is often the message, and people, it did take a while to bring it down. It may be the case ultimately that the business model regarding these algorithms will have to shift, or that people will tire of it. Right now, it's a great source of dopamine hits for young people, but there may come a time when their interest goes elsewhere, right? And hopefully that would be a case, and it would bring us back to a lingua franca while still making it access to information still available, as you described, the democratization.
In the short term, wouldn't it be nice if more of our young people understood that there is a fundamental tension here, and that if you don't like what Father Coughlin is saying, is that a sufficient case to prevent him from expressing himself? And then the question is, what can be done politically, legally, economically, in ways that do not necessarily compromise other core...
The First values. Amendment.
First Amendment, yeah. We deal with this a lot these days, as you know, in higher education, where there's a big argument about just how far does this free speech doctrine really go. Maybe that's for the next book. Again, without necessarily thinking that I have a specific answer to that question, I do think it would be helpful for more young people growing up in a complicated, very tumultuous world to be able to think about a problem, not only from the point of view of, you know, that guy's wrong and let's shut him down, but rather from the standpoint of why are we even in a pickle when it comes to this sort of situation? What is it about this tension between an individual's right to say all kinds of outrageous things and the effect it has on society? Is there anything in there that can help young people rethink some of those relationships? And then, of course, they can take it to the Supreme Court and see how they feel about the encroachment on First Amendment rights or whatever it would be. But in the meantime, I think that we have a lot of people, not just in high school, we have a lot of people who simply do not, who were either absent on the day that some of this was being taught or weren't paying attention, or maybe it wasn't being taught, that there are these built-in tensions between individual rights and social consequences. For me, that would be a good place to focus some more of our attention. And as long as everybody's got their favorite definition of civics, mine would be to include a capacity to understand some of those kinds of problems.
All right. Well, this has been a fun conversation, and I thank you for the book. I hope it's doing very well, and we're glad that you wrote it.
Well, thanks.
And we'll look forward to the next one in which you chart the path forward here in the interest of our national security and common good.
We didn't actually talk too much about national security, but I got to tell you, I agree with what I think is your proposition here, that national security is not just a matter of good technology and missile defense. It's also a matter of preparing people to function creatively and effectively in a democracy. I'm with you on that.
And I think that our unity, even when we disagree, is a critical component to our national security. And we don't always need a common enemy to get to that.
Yeah.
And that has traditionally been where we go, but I don't think we have to go there. So anyway, I'm glad you came on. It was wonderful to talk to you. Our guest tonight has been Michael J. Foyer, and he again is the author of Can Schools Save Democracy? You can find it in bookstores right now. He is also the host of the EdFix podcast, which we'll hyperlink in the notes. Thank you for joining us. We're going to turn now to national security news. In a not free and not fair election, Vladimir Putin claims he has won 88% of the vote in Russia. I think that's down from 98 because somebody told him that doesn't sound credible. He's now serving a fifth term, and that means he is on course to exceed the length of time that Joseph Stalin, Stalin, served in office. And Pakistan has made airstrikes inside Afghanistan, apparently directed at warning the Tawik Taliban a militant Pakistani group now collecting inside of Afghan borders. This is an alarming situation between Afghanistan and Pakistan. It could easily escalate. In Niger, the new military junta has terminated ties with the U.S. military and is apparently positioned to sell uranium to Iran. This move would certainly end the $110 million U.S. military base there that flies drones over West Africa and the Sahel, where ISIS and other terrorist groups and the Wagner militia are currently active and seeking to expand and claim territory, and the many minerals and resources that Africa has more than almost any other continent. Currently, there are 600 U.S. troops in Niger. The junta, again, has also been solidifying ties with Russia and two Moscow-aligned generals that now run nearby countries Burkina Faso and Mali. The Houthis of Yemen have cut the internet cables that run on the floor of the Red Sea, and it's causing global internet traffic to be rerouted. These garden hose-sized cables, you remember we may have discussed when we were talking about deep sea mining in the Clarion-Clipperton zone, again, to get minerals. This is a major development, but not unexpected, because in almost all combat, communication lines have been cut by enemies, including the telegraph lines to the UK, to the England then, by the Nazis during World War II. All right, now on the topic of internet access, Cuba of all places, unexpectedly, I guess, unless you really know, Cuba has cut back on mobile internet in response to protests in the streets there over power outages and a lack of food. And an espionage probe has found communication devices on Chinese cranes at U.S. ports. All that crazy stuff sometimes we hear, apparently it's true. Europe's NATO, the nations of NATO in Europe, now is going to face a $65 billion spending gap. More on this. If you didn't hear our podcast last week with Professor Simon Miles on NATO, the history of NATO, and some of the concerns about ultimately us being drawn into Ukraine with American forces, please listen to that podcast. This is deeply concerning. In any event, thank you so much for listening to National Security Law Today. Remember to share this podcast with a friend. Remember to discuss ideas, trying to listen to another person's point of view. Try to spend time with people who don't look or think exactly like you. Our unity is our national security. Your writer producer is me, Elisa Poteet. I'm always here in my individual capacity. Our editor is Frances Burkholm. She's also my co-producer. My other co-producer is Holly McMahon, who can do anything, juggle plates, dance, write a memo all at the same time, as well as the towering intellects and wonderful people that form the Standing Committee on Law and National Security, without whom this podcast would not be possible. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.